For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
All right. We're going to be looking at Hebrews 13, verse 9, which I entitled Remaining on Target. We're really going to be looking at just this one verse where the author of Hebrews says, "Do not be carried away by varied and strange teachings, for it is good for the heart to be strengthened by grace, not by foods, through which those who were so occupied were not benefited." So, apparently, the audience of Hebrews was experiencing this false teaching or this varied and strange teaching. And the author of Hebrews gives us sort of a clue as to what they were facing. He says that it's not by foods through which we are strengthened. So, the New International Version includes, it's not by ceremonial foods, which I think makes sense in the context. Based on what we see in the passage, it's very clear that the audience were looking to some sort of ceremonial food in order to gain this sense of spiritual well-being. Now, if you look at the background of Hebrews, we know that the audience of Hebrews were tempted to go back under the yoke of slavery to the law. And in some cases, people were confused as to whether or not Jesus indeed played the role of a high priest. And so many of these Jewish believers were tempted to go back to the temple and offer sacrifices. In addition to this, it seems like there was this belief, maybe a superstitious belief, that once they offered the sacrifice, the meat that they would take home with them, they could use to make a special meal, and that meal actually built them up spiritually. And this is actually supported by verse 10, where the author says, "We have an altar from which those who minister at the tabernacle have no right to eat." So it's clear that they are falling into some sort of superstitious teaching or belief about this ceremonial food or this probably meat that was sacrificed in the temple. Now, he goes on to say, though, that we shouldn't be dragged away or carried away by all types of varied and strange teachings. I think it's quite interesting that the author of Hebrews didn't use false teaching, and he could have done that very easily. Instead, he chooses to use this word varied and strange teaching, which seems to suggest that they were subject to a type of teaching that was off balance or off target. Let's look at each one of these. First of all, he says that there's varied teaching. And this literally means diverse or multicolored. It's actually the same word that is used for Joseph's robe in Genesis 37, in the Greek translation of the Old Testament. And so this describes teaching that sort of misses the point or maybe has the wrong kind of emphasis. And you see these sorts of things creep into Christian teaching all the time. You know, you see, for example, an overemphasis upon either systematic or biblical theology. You know, systematic theology seeks to try to harmonize all of the various passages throughout the Bible to come up with a consistent picture of Christian doctrine. And that could be very valuable, but, you know, we've all sat through teachings where somebody will encounter a theme in the passage, and that will serve as sort of a launch pad for some sort of discursus on the topic. And, you know, the teaching runs into so many detours that it manages never to find its way back to the main point. And so this sort of tangential teaching is probably an aspect of what he's talking about. But also you see this too in this overemphasis on biblical theology, where there's this insistence upon remaining in the text even though there are confusing elements to it. I remember sitting through a seminary class on the book of Job, and the Old Testament professor who taught this class suggested that Satan in Job chapter 1 and 2 wasn't actually Satan like we know. Because the word is actually the Satan, which was used of Balaam's ass in Numbers. And so what he said was, I believe that this simply represents a prosecuting attorney among the angelic hosts who was challenging God. I don't think it's Satan the way that we know Satan. And we'd say, well, what about Genesis, you know, chapter 2, where Satan tempts the original man and woman? And he says, well, we're studying the book of Job, not Genesis. And so you could see how an insistence upon remaining in the text, even though you're encountering confusing elements and failing to harmonize that with the rest of what the Bible says, can actually lead you to incorrect interpretations. Also, you might run into what you might call fashionable theology. If you ever look through the list of biblical criticism, there's like 24 types of biblical criticism, including types of criticism such as form criticism, where, you know, in the Old Testament, when it was applied, it helped us understand a lot about Hebrew poetry and wisdom literature. And yet we see that people had sort of gone off the rails and were looking at the New Testament and trying to figure out what the base message was and trying to get rid of all the accretions and all of the embellishments that crept into the text. Or, you know, for example, redaction criticism, which became very popular over the last 50 years, where there is this desire to understand why the author chose to put in certain elements and chose to leave out certain elements. And again, that's valuable, but, you know, we have to understand the body of what God says in totality. And so it's easy to sort of fall into this fashionable theology where the newest, greatest trend in theology captures our eye and we sort of run with it. Also, you might run into what might be called theological oversteering, where as a result or as a response to a certain problem that we see, we overemphasize and teach on a certain area that we think will balance it out, thus creating another problem and another over-imbalance. Really, I think the driving force behind some of these varied teaching would be, first of all, fear. You know, we sense that there's a problem. It's easy to overreact and to overstate things, to overemphasize things that maybe the Bible doesn't emphasize out of fear that this problem is growing out of control. Also, there might be a thirst for the new or esoteric. You know, C.S. Lewis suggests that in the modern day, we make judgments based on what he calls chronological snobbery. What a great term. Which he defines as the assumption that whatever has gone out of date is on that account alone discredited. In other words, whatever is new is what's best. And so there is this desire to go after what we think is new, that whatever is new is superior to what came before it. In addition to that, I think that there is this desire for esoteric teaching, this belief that we have specialized knowledge. And we should be suspicious when we hear people say things like, you can't really understand Jesus's teaching unless you understand, you know, extra-biblical, rabbinic, first century writings. Or you really can't understand the sayings of Jesus unless you understand the eschatological expectation of the Jews in the first century. Although those things help us in our understanding, it's not the key to unlocking what Scripture says. I love what Spurgeon says on this. I'm quite sure that the religion of Jesus Christ was never intended only for the highly cultured. So if you bring me a gospel which can only be understood by gentlemen who have passed through Oxford or Cambridge University, I know that it cannot be the gospel of Christ. He meant the good news of salvation to be proclaimed to the poorest of poor. In fact, the gospel is intended for humanity in general. So, if you cannot make me understand it, or if, when I do understand it, it doesn't tell me how to deliver its message in such a plain language that the poorest man can comprehend it, I tell you, sirs, that your newfangled gospel is a lie. I will stick to the old one, which a man only a little above an idiot in intellect can understand. Well, I think the second type of teaching that we want to look at, too, is strange teaching. And this word is actually the Greek word xenos, where we get the word xenos from. But in the context, it refers to something coming from an external source, strange or foreign. So it's something that gets introduced into our teaching from an external source. And I think that there are a couple of ways that this happens. Or an example of this would be, you know, for example, liberation theology. During the 60s and 70s, as Marxism and communism was growing, spreading throughout the world, many Latin American theologians believed that they could combine Christianity with Marxist thought, and they came up with liberation theology. Also, you see the rise of liberal theology. You know, in the 1800s, the late 1800s and early 1900s, you know, there was really at the time this modernistic view of the world that led people to come up with different ideas like the quest for the historical Jesus or the JEDP theory, seeking to try to mimic the culture and its importance that it placed on rationalism. And really, when you look at the driving force behind strange teaching, I think that you could isolate it to two things. First of all, cultural accommodation. We see this today. For example, we're under incredible pressure to conform to our culture, especially in the area of homosexuality. And so as a result, Christians have succumbed to that and have developed a queer theology to accommodate our culture. In addition to that, you see people falling into this strange teaching because they're uncritically aping our culture. They don't understand culture, and so when these new ideas start to spread in the church, they uncritically gulp it down. You know, you think about the emerging church movement, one of the more destructive movements that I've seen since I've been following God. It's ripped away large chunks of Christians in America. And, you know, it's very interesting because when I look at our church, we managed to weather that storm relatively unscathed. And I believe that it was in large part because we had a jump on postmodernism. Compliments of guys like Francis Schaeffer, who had influenced us really from the beginning of our inception. I remember reading this book, The God Who Is There, written 50 years ago. I remember reading this nearly 20 years ago and thinking to myself, this is incredible that, you know, we as Christians can remain relevant in our culture. And also that we can speak in such a way that gives us credibility and a common connection with non-Christian people. It totally changed my thinking. In particular, I remember this stair-step diagram in his book where he points out that really worldviews drift along these lines from philosophy all the way down to the theologian. Schaeffer comments, theology has been last for a long time. It's curious to me in studying this whole cultural drift that so many pick up the latest theological fashion and hail it as something new. But in fact, what the new theology is now saying has already been said previously in each of the other disciplines. In other words, Christians have always been behind. The Christian is to resist the spirit of the world, but we must understand the world's spirit does not always take the same form in every generation. So the Christian must resist the spirit of the world and the form it takes in his own generation. And if he does not do this, he is not resisting the spirit of the world at all. And so it's important for us to understand our culture, understand not only the different things that our culture does that really speaks about its values, its worldview, but understand the worldview underlying those behaviors that drive people in our culture so that we don't become subject to those values and that worldview. He also says, those standing in the stream of historic Christianity have been especially slow to understand the relationship between various areas of thought. Do we Christians understand this shift in the contemporary world? If we do not understand it, then we are largely talking to ourselves. In other words, if we don't understand what our culture believes, if we don't understand their worldview, if we don't understand our culture, then we're going to be largely talking to ourselves. We're going to be irrelevant in our world. Now, I think that in large part, this diagram, this stair-step diagram, actually fits pretty well today. And yet, I would say that when it comes to philosophy, the scientists, in many ways, have replaced the philosopher. Many scientists today are self-styled philosophers claiming to understand more than the philosopher. For example, Stephen Hawking in The Grand Design says, traditionally, when he was talking about questions of existence and how did we even get here, he says, these questions were for philosophy, but philosophy is dead. It is not kept up with the modern developments in science, particularly in physics. As a result, scientists have become the bearers of the torch of discovery in our quest for knowledge. And this is largely, I think, what people believe, that science really is the only way to obtain objective truth. Anything that falls outside of those confines really is just in the area of subjectivity. And yet, it's interesting that when you look at his statement, it sort of strikes you as more than a scientific statement. It's actually a metaphysical statement about science, right? And yet, when you encounter people today, especially young people, whenever you claim an authority such as a scientific study, most young people will accept that and show incredible skepticism and cynicism to other disciplines, such as history. I remember I was talking to my high school disciple. He's 15 years old. And I said, yeah, it's really interesting that it seems like in our modern day, we're not really educating people. We're just training them to be technicians in a specific field. And he said, yeah. He's like, why do I have to take history? Who cares when Mao Zedong lived? And he had the opposite view that I did. I was like, well, I'm a history major. That actually matters to me, right? And I pointed out to him, I said, history is not just about memorizing facts and chronologies. It's about thinking critically about history, understanding, for example, how the different factors leading up to World War II were decisive. And to him, he just felt like, well, that's just totally useless. In addition to that, I've noticed that an increasing number of young people claim to be either atheistic or agnostic. When you look at the most recent poll research study on this, atheism in America has nearly doubled. And people who consider themselves to both be either agnostic or atheist, or also falling in the category of the nuns, that is, those who don't have any religious affiliation, are about 25% of Americans today. Also, I think that there's sort of this uncertainty of the world in which they live, which gives way to despair. You know, especially among the young people that I encounter, high schoolers. You know, these are kids who grew up during the Great Recession of 2008 and 2009. They watch their parents lose their jobs, lose their homes. They're under constant threat of a mass school shooting, worried about, you know, a terrorist threat striking their town and their family. And so there's this fear, this uncertainty about the world that they live in that affects them. And therefore, what I've noticed is that they try to construct meaning through experiences and the mundane. It's almost characteristic of the existential philosophers. I was talking to this one high school student. He's really sharp and claimed to be an atheist. And I remember having this long dialogue with him over a span of a few weeks. And I tried to point out to him that really without God, without the metaphysical, there's no basis for significance or meaning in your life. And I said, you know, how do you explain why your life matters? And he says, well, I feel like the things that I do, the experiences that I have, that gives my life meaning and significance. And I said, that sounds like existential philosophy. He's like, what's that? So he shows up next week. He said, you know, you use that term existential philosophy. He said, I looked up some of those guys and I came across this guy named Camus. I was like, yeah, Camus. He says, yeah, that's what I believe. And so it's interesting that there's almost a revival of this in this world of uncertainty that many of these students live. It's interesting, too, in the area of art. I've been reading a lot about art history, and it's very interesting to see how this sort of existential worldview is really marked in art today, contemporary art. There's this famous artist named Sai. I'm refusing to try to pronounce his last name there, but it's interesting. He uses gunpowder on canvas, and what he tries to do is he uses gunpowder in order to try to create some of these ephemeral images. And he states that in the history of gunpowder making, he says, those who developed gunpowder were actually those looking for an elixir to make themselves immortal. And so it's interesting when you see him introduce this into his art that there's almost this sense that he's trying to create a sense of meaning from something commonplace through these performances. In this famous documentary called The Sky Ladder, Sai was actually seeking to, really, he was on a quest for 2 decades to try to complete this sky ladder, which essentially was this ladder held up by this hot air balloon, 1,600 feet in the air, strapped with fireworks. And he tried to complete this a number of occasions and failed to do so, and finally accomplished it in the middle of this rural part in China with just a handful of people watching. And for months, videos of this sky ladder never surfaced until finally one day somebody posted this. And in 2 days, there were 30 million views of this. And so it's very interesting when you look at, you know, his work. I mean, obviously, he doesn't give us a very straightforward artist statement, but it's very clear that what he's trying to do is he's trying to take something mundane and trying to create meaning from it through these sort of non-repeatable one-time performances. Here's another guy. His name is Joan Cornea. He's a Spanish illustrator. And he creates sort of dark and humorous cartoons. Here's another one of his cartoons, which I think are very interesting. And it's interesting when he talks about his art, he says, although my sense of humor has always been black and absurd, I think my work reflects the cynicism of real life, not mine. And so what he's trying to capture is this sort of cynicism that people in our culture, in our world feel. Here's another interesting sculpture by Ron Mueck called The Mask. And here you have, you know, this figure that seems suspended between sleep and death. And it's interesting, Kelly Grovier, who wrote a book on art history comments that the title appears to comment upon the superficial culture of discarded personas and disposable selves. That really fits with what you see in our culture today, where, you know, there's this desire to try to create our own sense of identity, who we are, either by curating what we put on social media to try to project an image of ourselves to the people around us, those who follow us. And really, it's all about creating self. Okay, when you look at the area of music, it's very interesting to look at some of the music today, and I'm not going to go too far into this, but I know a recent study suggests that people after the age of 33 stop listening to new music, and they pulled that from Spotify data. And I'm not exactly sure if that's true or not, but I know that a couple weeks ago I was hanging out with the elders at the elders retreat, and I curated this, you know, playlist called the classic rock playlist. You know, it consists of 60s rock, and you know, I'd play songs, and you know, as the Rolling Stones would come on or Led Zeppelin, you know, all the guys, you know, the older guys would be like, "Oh, it's so good. Oh man, so awesome." And as you would get to the tail end of that era, you know, I'd play like Can, right, which was like maybe early 70s. They would all be like, "Oh, why did you turn that off? Why are we listening to this trash?" You know, and you could tell it was almost like their taste in music was frozen in time. Well, as the night progressed and the old guys went to bed, all the young guys were still playing cards. And I changed up the playlist. I played a 90s playlist and I played the Gin Blossoms, and all the guys were like, "Oh man, this is so good." And so it's interesting because, you know, obviously as we try to learn about our culture and understand our culture's worldview, I mean, it requires us remaining engaged. And, you know, I'm going to spare you from, you know, the mumble rap artists and the Spotify or the SoundCloud artists such as 6ix9ine that some of my high school students listen to. But it's actually interesting when you look at, you know, even something like SoundCloud rap and mumble rap, a lot of cultural analysts would say that this simplistic, subdued beat, often with snippets of strings and sometimes complemented with emo chords, paired with lyrics that ping-pong between braggadocio and nihilism with lots of sex and odes to heavy narcotics. They describe it as, you know, sort of this this type of music that seeks to try to slow things down, and when there are these open spaces to try to create reflection and meaning. Adam Evans says, "Mumble rap is a negotiation that offers relief from the invisible acceleration of life, its creativity born out of boredom." And, you know, we see also, too, in general culture that this sort of idea that, you know, life doesn't really matter, everything is uncertain, that many young people have adopted this wholesale. You know, many young people grasp for meaning and significance as they seek to collect experiences, oftentimes commemorating it on their skin or on social media. Also, young people no longer see technology as a tool. They view it as an extension of themselves. You know, our generation and previous generations viewed technology as something that helped us out. And yet, today, technology and your personhood are linked in an indistinguishable manner. And so often when people are, you know, posting content on social media, it's an expression of who they are. And really, the hollowness of this existential worldview leaves many feeling the dread of facing a meaningless world. As many of us probably know, the rise of suicide among teens has grown incredibly. It's actually the second leading cause of death among young people ages 15 to 24. And so we see this sense of dread, this sense of despair with many of the young people that we talk to. So how do we remain one step ahead of this next strange teaching that may come out of these different worldviews? I think, first of all, we need to realize that many of us have a cultural expert living right with us. You know, many of us have kids who are teenagers. And, you know, understanding and observing the media that they consume will help us to understand our culture better. You know, sometimes it requires us seeing and identifying a pattern, and then really it opens up a whole picture of where our culture is heading. You know, once a year, my son and I go and hang out with my friend, and we go morel mushroom hunting at an undisclosed location. And one of the things that's tricky about hunting morel is that, you know, if you've never seen a morel, it's really hard to identify them. You know, you could be standing right in front of a morel and not even see it. But when you get down and you see your first morel, you start to see them everywhere. And so, in the same way, you know, as we think critically, as we observe our kids and maybe our kids' friends, we start to identify patterns, ways of thinking, as we think critically about that. Secondly, we need to teach our kids and our disciples how to evaluate our culture critically. You know, I wonder whether or not we're teaching people to see the values of our culture, the worldview underlying the things that people in our culture do. You know, I fear that the ethos that really has been with Xenos from the very beginning, where we have had a sharp analysis of culture and have always been at the cutting edge of understanding where culture is heading, that it's possible that we might lose that in the next generation. But I think it's also important that as we evaluate our culture critically, that we also model this with compassion. Otherwise, we're going to come off as anti-cultural or just people who scoff. Instead, we need to weep. We need to feel a sense of sadness, just like Jesus did as he watched over the city of Jerusalem and wept over it because of its lostness. Francis Schaeffer says, "Don't be proud. As you look out across the world of sinners, weep for them. Be glad indeed if you are redeemed, but never forget as you look at others that you have been one of them. And in a real sense, we are still one of them, for we are still sinners. Christians are not special, a special group of people who can be proud. Christians are still those who are redeemed, and that is it. That's all." And so it's important for us to have that compassion, that sense of love for those who are lost, instead of sitting critically in judgment of them. So, really, there are two things that we can do to remain on target. I think they're very simple. First of all, we need to faithfully teach the personhood of Jesus. This comes directly from our passage in verse 8. Jesus Christ is the same yesterday, today, and forever. And so we need to teach who Jesus is, that he is indeed God and man, fully, and represent him as Scripture does. Also, we need to faithfully convey the work of Jesus. Look at verse 10. "Do not be carried away by varied and strange teachings, for it's good for the heart to be strengthened by grace." It's important that we arrive at grace every time we teach a passage. You know that old saying, "All roads lead to Rome." Well, that was literally true in the ancient world. If you look at a map of the ancient world, Rome had major highways that radiated out from the capital city. And so in the same way, whenever we teach a passage, there's always a way for us to arrive at the grace of God. Now, notice I didn't say at Christ, right? Not every the Bible doesn't have Christ on every single page. And yet, I do think that it's possible for us to arrive at the grace of God. You know, if you're teaching, for example, the life of Joseph, it's easy to want to try to paint Joseph as a Christ-like figure, and yet we have really no basis to say that. And yet, when we look at his life and God's sovereignty over his suffering, we can make the connection that Jesus, too, experienced God's sovereignty as he used Jesus' suffering to pay for all of humanity's sin. And so, I think as we capture those two things and do them faithfully, we'll remain on target.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.